You mentioned that the Masters, as you said, would like to keep the scientific truth of climate change from reaching, you know, the masses. To what end, I would ask? Are these people stupid? Do they not think that a global climate catastrophe would affect them? Or are they blind to it?
No, they're working on standard market principles. You're trying to maximize short-term profit and market share. That's what it means to be head manager of a corporation. You don't worry much about what's going to happen down the road. In fact, by now, after the changes of the last 30 years, changes in state-introduced changes, incidentally, in corporate and the rules of corporate governance and so on, that's even more true than it was in the past. I mean, in the past, if you go back, say, to the 1950s in the United States, the major corporations had a kind of a stake in the society, you know, kind of famous examples. Going back farther is Henry Ford raising wages to $5 so people would buy his cars. But if you go back to the 1950s, it's still true. So the head of GM, say, or GE, they had a stake in the health of the society. That's much less true today. With the radical changes in the way the economy was designed, and I mentioned designed because it was purposeful and conscious, there were alternatives, roughly in the late 70s, going on through the Reagan years and on, it was redesigned to sharply increase the role of finance, of financialization. By 2007, when the latest crash hit, financial institutions had about 40% of corporate profits, which is colossal. Go back to the big growth period, the 50s and 60s, banks were banks. They weren't even interstate banks, let alone huge investment firms. And there was a lot of regulation. New Deal regulation was in place, so, you know, no crises. But there's the big shift towards financialization and also towards export of production. So that, again, I mean, it's always happened, goes back to the early 19th century, but it really took off in the 70s and 80s. Along with that goes rapid concentration of wealth. It's gone way up. And concentration of wealth carries along almost reflexively concentration of political power, which leads to legislation which carries the vicious cycle further. But the end result is that, say, Apple or Google or GE, they don't care that much about the domestic population here. They got their workforce elsewhere in places where you can get cheap labor under hideous conditions and you don't have to worry about any constraints. And they have a kind of a global market. Actually, the situation was pretty well described in a brochure that was put out by Citigroup a couple of years ago. Citigroup, this huge banking conglomerate, which once again is feeding at the public trough of, as it's been doing ever since the early 1980s, its predecessor in the early 1980s. You crash, you go to the taxpayer, he bails you out, they're doing it again. But they put out a brochure for investors, which is worth reading. Urged investors to keep to what they call their plutonomy index, which apparently way outperformed the general index of stocks since the 80s, since the Reagan years. Plutonomy means the wealthy, the very wealthy, globally. I mean, they happen to be concentrated heavily in the United States and England, a couple of other countries, but it's all over. You go to a sub-Saharan country, there are people with spectacular wealth. So just pay attention to the plutonomy, the ones where, you know, the very wealthy, and the rest we can kind of forget about. Actually, there's a name for the rest. They're sometimes called the precariat, people who live a precarious existence. And it's advisable that people be driven to the precariat. Sometimes that's even said by the gurus of the modern economy. Alan Greenspan, for example, when he was still St. Alan, you know, before everything crashed. But this was back in the late 90s. When he was testifying to Congress, and he was hailing the wonderful economy he was running, he explained to Congress that it's based substantially on what he called growing worker insecurity, which is a very healthy thing from the point of view of economic theory. Because if workers are insecure, they're not going to ask for higher wages and benefits, and therefore you can make more profit. So therefore he's doing fine. So we have a global precariat and a global plutonomy. I mean, not, you know, they vary from country to country. And that's the real shift in the economy. It's not from the US to China, that's mostly myth. But there is a shift towards a global split between a plutonomy and a precariat. But that means that the ones who own and manage the economy just care less than before about their own society as long as it continues to provide a powerful state which can bail them out when they get into trouble, can protect them from adverse consequences, and can keep producing the innovations and creative activity that drive the economy forward. And that's what we're moving towards.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more? Get one more right here.
Do you think the system of bailing out financial institutions when they collapse, do you think that system can be continued without bringing out about either hyperinflation with increasing the money supply or a change in the monetary system?
The increased financialization. It's kind of interesting. After the crash a couple of years ago, there were some articles in the professional economics journals for the first time, really, saying that there's been a kind of a gap in the economics profession. We haven't really asked whether the financial institutions have a positive or negative impact on the economy, which is pretty dramatic when you think how they've exploded in the last 40 years. And a number of them said, Robert Solow at MIT, Nobel laureate, was one of them, that if we did investigate this question, we'd probably find that they have a generally harmful effect. Actually, some take a much stronger stance. So the most respected financial correspondent in the English-speaking world, I think, is probably Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, very good economist, highly respected. He describes the financial institutions as like a larva that eats away at its host from the inside. The host is the market system. And I think there's some evidence that that's true. So can we go on? Well, you know, I referred to the director of the Bank of England, who says we're in a doom loop and describes why. And it's pretty well understood with the government insurance policy, which runs tens of billions of dollars a year to the big banks, encourages risk. There is a weak legislation, the Dodd-Frank bill, which is really just the framework of legislation. It has to be filled out in detail. And ever since it was passed, industry lobbyists are hard at work to try to make sure that it doesn't mean anything, and they'll probably succeed, which means, yes, we'll be in a further doom loop. So that's one problem. That's one crisis that's coming along, escalating. I think it's sort of inherent in the system. Could be. That one you could modify, you know, like by sensible regulation and so on. But there's another one that you may not be able to modify, the one I was talking about. We may be coming to a point not too far in the future where it'll be impossible to do it. And as I said, in a financial crisis, the big banks can, you know, run to the nanny state to be bailed out. Nobody to run to in this case.
Professor Noam Chomsky addressing an assembly at Curry Auditorium at Northeastern University. The forum was called The Future of Capitalism and was sponsored by the Northeastern University Economics Department. This event was recorded by your announcer, Chuck Rosina, for the Boston Community Radio Project. Thanks for listening.